basically, it's a narrative that they write about what it's going to be. And then they work backwards from that document and they say, okay, this is what we're going to create. One of the employees told me, it's like being a science fiction writer. You write the future and then you build your way into it.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. How did you subscribe to this podcast in the first place? Was it Apple Podcasts? Or how did you discover Future Proof in the first place? Was it through a Facebook post or a Google ad? Or maybe you've been following my work since you bought one of my books on Amazon. These companies are all part of big tech, the companies every competitor seems to fear, and yet they're also the ones us consumers are most beholden to. That's part of why some of these companies' leaders were on Capitol Hill for hearings recently. One of the journalists who knows these companies best is Alex Kantrowitz, who is most recently a senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed News and based in San Francisco. He's now the author of Always Day One from Penguin Portfolio, where he discusses how Amazon, Facebook, Google, Apple, and Microsoft have encouraged moving fast and challenging the status quo, and how we can all learn something from how these companies innovate. I think you'll find this very interesting, so let's jump right in. So, Alex, welcome to Future Proof. It's great to have you here, and I wanted to ask, you had a shift somewhat recently, but I'd like to ask everybody at the beginning who they are and what they do on a day-to-day basis.
That's right. So up until a couple months ago, I was a senior technology reporter at BuzzFeed News and covered the tech giants, and left in June to start my own publication called Big Technology, which is a newsletter on Substack, which you can find just going on Google and typing in Big Technology Substack. And then also my own podcast, Big Technology Podcast. You can type Big Technology Podcast and find it that way. And this is all about covering the tech giants in a way that I didn't think I was able to do if I wasn't being independent. So looking at these companies in a way that doesn't exactly fit the cookie cutter definition of what a news story is for a mainstream publication like BuzzFeed. And then I also just wrote the book Always Day One, which looks at the work cultures of Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, and basically explains how they do what they do by looking not at the symptoms, but the physiology, and then giving you an understanding of the way the tech giants work. So you'll be able to co-opt their systems and use them in your own workplace.
And so I'm part of the way through how a lot of interviewers, they'll say, I read the book, it's fascinating, it's clear that they haven't. And I downloaded it two nights ago. By the time this episode airs, I will have finished it. And I feel like it's pretty breezy of a read for anybody who's very interested in this type of topic. I will say I'm listening to it, so maybe that makes it breezier for me. But what inspired the name of the book, Always Day One? It's just basically Jeff Bezos's philosophy towards startup and innovation. Can you go into that a bit?
Yeah. So it's the way that the tech giants all operate, even though Bezos did coin the term. I'll start just by saying that if you tried to create a company last century, you could basically run that company your entire lifetime on one idea. The average company on the Fortune 500 in the 1920s lasted 70 years there. Today, companies last 15 years on the Fortune 500 in terms of the average lifespan. So in order to succeed in today's economy, you need to be continually reinventing your company. And to persist, you're going to have to come up with idea after idea. And that's what this idea is of Always Day One inside the tech giants. None of these companies believe that they'll be able to succeed long-term on one flagship idea. They're in a state of constant reinvention. And Always Day One sort of means inventing as if you're a startup, right? Most big companies, they get so big, but they don't want to reinvent because they have a legacy business to protect and they don't want to threaten it or do anything that would distract them. A startup on the first day can do whatever it wants. It's unencumbered by legacy products. And so that's the key here for the tech giants, is that they can act as if it's their first day and continually reinvent. And that's what's kept them in the game for so long.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because there's this kind of assumption that everybody has, which is big companies get very big and they're afraid of creative cannibalization. But I think that you're right that for these big tech firms, they don't really have to play by those rules. They can afford some creative cannibalization and still have a major lead on competitors in a number of different categories.
That's right. And the way they do it is by creating, you can't just walk up and say we want to have an always day one mentality and then you just have it. Like the way they do reinvent themselves is by reimagining the way that they actually operate inside the workplace. And so I think that the key for them is the actual culture side of it. And the way that they're able to do that is by using technology to minimize the type of work that would support existing products to make room for their employees to come up with new ones. And it's been pretty effective for all these companies throughout their existence to be able to do this.
How do they, and I think this is one thing we should probably clarify. So for your book, how do you define big technology? Because you cover a few big tech firms in particular.
That's right. So the firms are Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, the five most powerful tech companies in the world.
Which is so interesting to me because I feel like in some ways, the consumer at the very least has not focused as much on some versus others. So for instance, Facebook, I think, and Amazon probably get the most ire right now. And maybe it's just the people I speak to, but it seems that Microsoft doesn't get any. But yet, if you look in terms of their reach, they are, you know, quite expansive and have a major impact on our society. But yet, without that negative buzz around their brands, I don't know. I've always found that to be interesting. Google obviously has detractors, but not nearly as much, in my view, as the Facebooks and Amazons of the world.
That's right. And Microsoft's definitely been through the ringer already. With its previous antitrust go-around with Congress. And they also create some pretty boring products, like they're very much in the enterprise world. In fact, I was actually going to leave them out of the book to begin with. But their culture is so dialed in and such an example of the way that a company should be run today, definitely compared to when they were, you know, operating under Steve Ballmer, that at a certain point, I had no choice but to include them. They're an incredibly important company, and I think you can learn a lot about the way that Satya Nadella, a lot about the workplace by looking at the way that Satya Nadella has transitioned that company from an asset protecting company, which they were under Ballmer when they protected Windows, to one that really builds for the future, which they're doing under Satya.
But how, let's go into a little bit in greater detail, how big tech prioritizes reinvention and innovation over tradition. Because I think that's really interesting. And I think that's something that a lot of companies aspire to do. And frankly, even if they're in a different type of business, I think that there are a lot of industries that probably could learn from that type of methodology.
Yeah, that's right. So these companies, they have built into their DNA the spirit of reinvention. And I think that, like, with most big companies, there's this idea of just sitting down and protecting the fort is learned, where like employees will come in and they'll have ideas for the first 6 months of the way the company can be better and what it should invent and how they can improve certain systems and processes. And they have all this energy. And then after the first 6 months, they've been told, no, we don't really want you to do that. That's not important. Stay in your lane, that they stop coming up with ideas. And then they understand that they're just there to do a job. And inside the tech giants, I would say it's the opposite, where that like employee ideas are valued. They're not just told their value, but actively sought out. And there are systems inside any of these companies where they take employees' ideas and bring them to decision makers as soon as they can. So if there's an idea for a new product or service, it always has the chance of seeing the light of day when the system is working well, which has helped these companies pick out the good ones and build them and then find their way to the next evolution of their company pretty often.
I feel like that ties into your whole entire idea, how you talk about these big tech firms put collaboration over ownership, which I think is a different way of thinking for a lot of people who work in firms that don't have that philosophy. So how does that work based off of your research?
Yeah, that's right. It's a super scary thing to do, to be able to collaborate, because you do need to give up a lot of power and control. And can I give you like a couple of examples from the book that might illustrate why it's so important?
Totally, yeah.
So why has Google built an effective voice assistant in the Google Assistant, where Apple, which had a 6-year head start, still is struggling with Siri? And the answer is the way they collaborate. Google is known as a company that has a hive mind. So ideas flow pretty fast inside Google. They have internal social networks. They have listservs. They have Q&As with their leadership. Inside Google, you can be working in one division, email somebody in another division, and that's encouraged, not frowned upon. And because they're collaborating so well, the idea of building a product like the Google Assistant, which takes in not just search, but mail and YouTube and maps and messaging and music and puts them all together into one coherent service. By collaborating, they were able to build that. Apple, on the other hand, is a company that exists in silos, right? So they took the Siri team and essentially said, what we want you to do is sit in this closet and build a good voice assistant. But you can't do that if you're not able to go out into the company and actually go out and speak with all the different divisions. And because Apple has neglected to build that collaboration culture inside the company, Siri's terrible. The HomePod, which was their answer to the Echo and the Google Home, is performing so poorly that eMarketer won't even name it as a category. It's in the other category, whereas Amazon's Echo and the Google Home have their own. This is all product of collaboration, and especially today, where the work that we're doing is so multidisciplinary and dependent on divisions across the company, where no one has a monopoly on knowledge in the company anymore, the way they might have in the past. This idea of collaboration becomes much more important. And I think that folks reading the book, you'll see that there's a way to do this. It's embodied by Google, and there's a way not to do this, and that's embodied by Apple.
Yeah, I think, so we're recording this the day after the big tech hearings on Capitol Hill, and we're talking about collaboration, but yet I think it's interesting, obviously, the buck stops at a few key leaders for these organizations who have to be held accountable by the government in terms of their operations. What did you think in terms of how those hearings unfolded?
So I was in the room for the Zuckerberg hearing, and I would say that this was like a marked improvement over that one. The members of Congress came in. Most of them seemed prepared. Even if they wanted to grind an axe, they actually knew what they were talking about for the most part. Questioning was tough, and they didn't let these CEOs off the hook, and there were follow-up rounds. So when they brushed aside questions in one round, then other members could come in and try to follow up and pin them in places they want. But ultimately, look, we're living in a world right now where Congress doesn't work with each other. They're dealing with a massive health crisis, a massive economic crisis, an election crisis.
There's a health crisis? There's a fun 2020 game called See How Long You Can Go Without Voldemort Rearing Its Head. And we went 12 minutes. We're doing well.
So. We did good. Yeah, it's nice to forget about the coronavirus when you can. But yeah, Congress isn't going to do anything. These companies, because they're so preoccupied with things like that virus, the economic crisis, and the upcoming election, that this was like one of the top things on their agenda for 2020. Now it's towards the bottom. So ultimately, if you're a tech giant, you're feeling pretty good about what happened in Washington, even if you took a few body blows. Ultimately, you came out on top.
Yeah. And I think that you're probably right that there wasn't that much that they can do short of a major, not unforced error, that would cause regulation to happen faster. I think part of what you hit the nail on the head about, you basically have junior staffers who are prepping these people who are not that present and not... They don't understand these technologies that they are being tasked to regulate. They think they understand them, but, and this is just in my conversations with people who work for some of those congressional leaders, it's a matter of, they know that it's important. They don't know necessarily what to do about it and don't feel that comfortable taking a major action if it's not their subject matter expertise. Basically, we need Alex to just make a call for what to do here.
Yeah, you look at Congress, like even in a good moment, they were still yelling at each other. They can't walk by each other in the halls without cursing each other out. So I think that they're going to do a big antitrust overhaul is wishful thinking, unfortunately, because the tech giants do need a check on their power.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to ask you about. It's how big of a problem is it for society that these big tech firms keep getting bigger and bigger? Because I'm of the opinion that there are certain things that no matter how big they get and no matter how much monopolistic power they have, it doesn't really hurt society. And then there are some things where if you wanted to create, let's say, a competitor to Facebook, you can't. There's not a viable path to creating that product. You basically have to go into an entirely different industry or something that's underserved because Facebook has the ability, let's say, and I'm picking on Facebook, but this is true for any of these companies, that they can squash you in your crib if they so choose.
That's right. Look, here's what I think. More than having the ability for other companies to go in and compete with the companies, what our country really needs is a strong middle of the economy. We need strong small businesses. We need strong mid-sized businesses. And, you know, what the size of the tech giants does is it creates marketplaces that these small and mid-sized businesses have no choice but to play in. If you're in advertising, we talked a little bit about marketing before the show. If you're in advertising, you got to use Facebook or Google. You often need to use both, right? If you're selling online, you almost have to use Amazon. And if you don't, you could use Shopify, but then you have to use Google. So you're held hostage. If you're an app developer, you have to use Apple's App Store. And so what you have is a situation where these companies' marketplaces have a tremendous amount of control over the businesses that are the lifeblood of the economy. And to have a healthy society, we need those businesses to thrive. The problem with these companies being so big is we know that there's been situations where they've used their power to make sure that the businesses, the small, medium-sized businesses, depending on them, are able to grow to some extent. But beyond that, they can't really grow. That's sort of Amazon's margin that you're taking. So Amazon will then underprice you or create a private label brand and come in and take your margin. And that's why Amazon is worth $1.5 trillion. And small mom and pops companies are struggling throughout the entire country. Same with news companies, right? News companies, they're at the mercy of Facebook and Google in terms of the amount of money that they're going to make, because they both use them for as a traffic sources and they use them to monetize their traffic. So that's what I think is the issue here. It's not necessarily the size. It's the marketplaces that they have power over and the fact that we're all subject to them. And so that's what we really have to keep vigilant about when we think about reining in these companies. It's not should they grow bigger or not, is are they using their power responsibly?
Yeah. And I think that this isn't necessarily my opinion. I think that they do a lot of things properly and have positive impacts on the economy, clearly. But at the same time, the challenge is are you the type of person who believes, like this is what everybody has to think, are you the type of person who believes that a company like Amazon is going to think about the long term versus the short term? Because in the short term, like you just said, if they need to protect their margins, then they are incentivized to squash somebody, you know, who's a smaller player, and then it's bad for the economy. But in the long term, yeah, it would probably be a good idea for them to make sure that nobody else forces regulation on them. And I think that's one of the things that I wonder about. We talked about the hearings a bit. I'm wondering, what do you think? How much of the onus for regulation should come from government versus big tech as a whole, even coming together and being responsible and having some type of self-regulation just so that others don't do it for them? Because I feel like the further they go, the more likely they might be to tempt government or force government's hand to try to, you know, regulate in some fashion.
Yeah, I think you touched on the answer in your question, right? Which is that they need to be afraid of getting regulated. So therefore, they will self-regulate themselves and act responsibly. The question is, are they afraid today? I would say absolutely not. We already know that our regulatory body is vastly underfunded. They don't have the resources to go after their companies in the way they would need to. The FTC's head of enforcement came out and said it essentially when they agreed to this $5 billion fine with Facebook that didn't slow Facebook down at all, where he said, if we went down this path a little bit longer, we wouldn't have gotten such a good outcome. Why is that? It's a resources question. It's a cash question. So I do think that they need to build themselves up into a body that can actually cause fear inside these companies. Another thing we should consider, the tech giants were already 17% of the S&P 500 before the pandemic started. Now they're 22%. And I wrote about this a little bit in my big technology newsletter this week. But the fact that there's such a big percent of the S&P, which is supposed to be a broad index that, you know, collects 500 companies that represent the economy, the fact that 22% of it is made of the tech giants means something is off there. It means that our economy is so reliant on them that actually going in and actually trying to push regulation in this type of world is exceedingly difficult. Because if you overregulate, you're going to end up crushing your constituents' net worth. So what I think these companies need is the healthy fear that regulation is possible and not this feeling of, let's show up on a video conference and then the government will get off of our back for another couple of years. And the way to do that is, without a doubt in my mind, to fund the enforcement agencies, fund the FTC, fund the DOJ, and actually give them some muscle. Don't necessarily need to use it, but the fact that it's there will start to cause these companies to pause a little bit before they go ahead and do nefarious things. Again, harming that middle of economy that we need to be strong in this country. And without it, we'll continue to crumble into chaos.
It's an interesting thought. I feel like crumble into chaos is just, we should have just ended there and no sign off. But no, I think that what you're saying is really interesting, because a lot of people are, like you said, a lot of consumers are so dependent on these companies that even I know a lot of people who might be critical of them, but then you ask them, are you using their services? And you really get down to the nitty gritty, and they might have a company that they begrudgingly say, I don't like that I'm dependent on it. And I imagine that government feels the same when you think about the fact that I don't know what percentage of all hiring in the US is by these big companies, but the more dependent the government, when we have a very high unemployment rate, the more dependent the government is on, listen, at least these companies are hiring human beings and then keeping the unemployment rate down, and then we don't have to subsidize. It becomes this
vicious cycle where it's hard to go after these companies. It's hard to criticize them because you are very dependent on them just to hire your people so that they can pay taxes.
That's right. Look, okay, I'm going to read you something from the big technology newsletter today if you're up for it. Just think about how dependent the federal government is on these companies. Their own employees need them to grow in order to be able to retire. California Public Employees Retirement System owns more than $1 billion in Facebook stock. The State Board of Administration of Florida owns hundreds of millions in Amazon. The State of Wisconsin Investment Board owns a chunk of Alphabet. New York State's Common Retirement Fund invests a small country's GDP worth in Apple. Okay, once you add in the ETFs, our future is basically tied to these companies, which is not what you want, because once you tie so deeply, you start to, you can't become an effective check on their power. And that's where they can run rampant on the people that actually need their services to succeed.
So I know, and I thought in terms of how I'm reading the book, I think that you can read it from a number of different vantage points. You can read it as somebody who's working in a large firm that's looking to see what are some of these processes and agility and nimbleness that you can adopt within your organization. I think that if you're starting something new, if you're starting a startup and you want to build something and adopt these techniques, but you also want to make sure that you build something that doesn't get in the way of some of these big tech firms. Do you have any advice for people who want to build something, but also their goal is not to sell to one of these firms, nor to be squashed within a 2-year period?
Look, I think that if you're going to try to compete with these companies without co-opting elements of their culture, you're going to be playing from behind. That's the bottom line for me. But once you start bringing the culture aspect into it, you're going to turn your company into something that's inventive, into something that's nimble, into something that won't fall prey necessarily to the big tech companies. Because it's a shame right now that these giant tech companies, usually when you have a big company, they become bureaucratic and slow and they fall apart. And these giant tech companies are more nimble than startups today. And that's a shame. You know, why? The answer is culture. So I think that once we have smaller and mid-sized companies start to co-opt some of the cultural elements that we see in the tech giants, we'll put ourselves in a much better economy than we're in today. And actually people who are, you know, in the driver's seat will start to have a chance. I'm a tiny small business now myself, having started big technology. And I'm definitely using some of the things that I learned when I wrote the book. For instance, like Amazon, before it kicks off any big project, has its employees write down the entire project, start to finish, what it's going to look like in the future. Basically, it's a narrative that they write about what it's going to be. And then they work backwards from that document and they say, okay, this is what we're going to create. One of the employees told me, it's like being a science fiction writer. You write the future and then you build your way into it. And whenever I need to figure out strategy or different things that I'm doing for this big technology publication, I write them down. And it helps spot gaps in your thinking. It helps you plan better. And then ultimately, it helps you execute better. And I think that's important. It's just one little element of, you know, tech giant culture that I, as a one-person business, have been able to implement and has been successful for me. And I think anybody that reads the book will find little bits and pieces of this type of stuff that will be useful in their daily lives.
No, I agree. I think that I know we have to let you go in a few, but I wanted to ask you, in terms of, we're talking about Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, which of these are the most quote unquote future proof and have the most defensible businesses? And when basically I'm thinking 3 years out, which I think is a reasonable mm-hmm. timeline, how are those companies doing in terms of financially and then being, which ones are being as impactful, if not more impactful than they are today?
I think they're all doing great. But if you ask me who's the most future proof, I would say Seattle over Silicon Valley. I think Amazon and Microsoft really hold the power to go forward. Amazon, because it's so inventive, because it really has this stranglehold on commerce, which isn't going away. And cloud business is doing tremendous for them. And you look at Microsoft, they are entrenched in the enterprise. And so because they've built these relationships with companies for so many years, they're going to persist in a pretty big way. And they've actually gotten their act together on cloud and on mobile under Satya and are set up for a really nice future. Google faces threat from Amazon. Facebook faces threat from everyone. It's the most vulnerable of all these tech companies. Tech is one example of why. And Apple is an asset milker right now. It's in a culture of refinement. It has the iPhone. It's trying to ride that ship all the way to the finish line. And we know in today's economy, given the stats I cited in the beginning of this, talking about how the average lifespan of a company on the Fortune 500 is 15 years, Apple can't ride one product forever. And so we'll ultimately need to fix its culture, make it more inventive, or it will find its way out of this top five.
Yeah, I will say out of those things that you just cited, what's very interesting is quote unquote insiders, if I'm going to put you and me in that category for a second, I think that people on the street don't necessarily realize how big Amazon's cloud computing business is. And it's immense. And it's a major factor in terms of why it's supporting itself so well. And I think that obviously, when we talk about a company like Apple, for all of their faults, and I think everything you said is true, they've been able to convert, like when you think about Apple Music or people paying for additional, you know, storage, cloud storage on a consumer level, they've been able to convert people over because they do have that large install base. So it is nice that they launch a new product and all of a sudden it's in the consideration set of 85% or more of their existing install base. So at least they have that going for them. But I think that generally your assessment is spot on. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to have you on in 36 months and see how we did.
Yeah. Look, just to address this last point, does anyone actually like paying for Apple stuff? You pay for storage because you're locked into it. I don't know if TV or Apple News has really taken off well. People who use Apple Music end up getting stuck and move to Spotify. So it's definite. This is asset milking behavior that they're doing, trying to make the most money out of the iPhone and not finding ways where they can build services that people actually want to use and move themselves into the future that way. Yeah, everybody that's come out and said stuff like this about Apple has been wrong. So yes, we should check in 36 months and see if I'm part of that category or if I actually got it right.
I think paraphrasing from somebody else that it's relatively easy to get the future. It's hard to get the time horizon correct. So there are all these people have been right before. I think they just estimated it's going to happen in this month and then it winds up happening later in the future. And then they can just be like, I told you. But to be continued, Alex, this was great.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Alex Kantrowitz for making the time. I don't know if you guys think as much about big tech as I do, but I do think, you know, they're a powerful force in the world. And, you know, while we have to be vigilant, we are getting so much out of them also. So it's really a double-edged sword, right? If you'd like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.